You're listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast.
At the dawn of May, there was a perfect plan.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 36 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast. My name is Kevin, I'll be your host for the show, and for this episode, we have a very special guest interview, and that is John Oates of Hall & Oates. And I can almost hear you asking, why is John Oates on an indie music podcast? Well, yes, you probably know that Hall & Oates had massive hit songs like Private Eyes and has sold millions of albums, but what you may not know is that Hall & Oates have been pursuing their music career as independent artists since the mid-90s. And it was around that time when they realized that there was no longer really a place for them in the mainstream music industry, so they decided to just do it themselves. I'll let John fill you in on the rest of the details, but for his latest solo album, Thousand Miles of Life, he decided to use CD Baby for his online distribution, and whenever I see an artist of that stature pop up on our site, I'm always curious to hear the story behind their decision to go independent. So, let's get to that story. Each step's a fork in the road that you're on. You're only flesh and bone. Not carved in stone. All right, well, joining me on the line is John Oates. John, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. How are you?
Doing good, and it's great to have you on the podcast, and especially someone who's basically, you've done it all in the industry. You've had major hit songs, you've released albums independently, and you've been in the industry for a long time, so I'm curious to hear some of your impressions about how much the industry has changed since you first started out.
Well, there's a big change as far as I'm concerned. I was very fortunate to start when I did. We started out at a time in the late 60s, early 70s when, artists were kind of respected for what they did, and the record companies were more of a partner in marketing and selling and did not get involved too much in the artistic side, which is, was a great way for us to start because, quite frankly, it took us three or four albums before we found our groove and had any real kind of commercial success. Mm-hmm. And I think in this day and age, had we been in the same position, we would never have gotten to that third or fourth album, unfortunately, because of the record business, the way it's, evolved and changed and I should say devolved, because I'm not that happy about it.
Yeah.
The record company got much more involved in the A&R and the creative side of things and the choosing of material. And the playing field has gotten, narrower and tighter, whereby, I think there's so many great artists out there, young artists, who have amazing potential and may never get to realize that potential because the record companies aren't interested in building a career. They're only interested in a quick sale. Fortunately for Daryl and I, we grew up in a time when we were allowed to make mistakes artistically and develop and get to the point where we found ourselves. And obviously, 35 years later, we're still making records. And I think that's a testament to that philosophy of artist and label relationships, which unfortunately doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, it's been an unfortunate thing to see the industry kind of resort to that. I'm kind of curious, you mentioned some mistakes and developing as an artist. What were some things that you guys did to keep growing at your craft at an early point in your career?
Well, I think, first of all, we had the confidence and we had the confidence of the label, knowing that we could, try some things and not necessarily have hits. And we felt that artistically they would stand behind us, and we were lucky. But as people, I think, we also had a very long-range view of our career. We were both, Daryl and I were both musicians from birth, really. As little kids, we were singers and performers. We played our instruments at 5 years old. So we really had a whole life before we actually started making records of, 15, 18 years of of thinking of ourselves as musicians. So when we actually got our first recording contract and started becoming professional recording musicians, we had already were fairly developed, and we thought, well, this is our life, and we're going to do this for a long time. Mm-hmm. We never took the view that, oh, you know, we better have a hit single and make a lot of money, and that's it for us. You know, we just figured, well, no matter what happens, we'll probably end up being musicians in some way or shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
It was just fortunate for us that things went our way and we worked really hard. But I just think that it was the way we looked at ourselves and we looked at our career, and fortunately, as I said before, had the support of the label.
When I was young, I watched the sun come up and thought the day would never end. And every sunset was a masterpiece that kept reminding me that the night would soon be over and the morning gonna come again. So we fill our lives, watch the.
Now, a lot of people might be surprised to find out that you've released some independent albums as well through your own label. What kind of brought that decision along? Most people would think that, you know, Hall & Oates, they have the, you know, no matter what they do, some label will want to put it out. What made you decide to go independent for some of your releases?
Well, it was not because we couldn't find a label that would put our music out. That wasn't the issue. We could. But what we would have to have dealt with, and the way that and this really dovetails into what we were talking about earlier, the way the record business changed and the way they dealt with their artists was not in keeping with an entire career of the way we were used to dealing with the business, and it didn't feel right. Basically, what happened was after the '80s and all our huge hits, and that bit was over, Daryl and I decided to step back a little bit and kind of reevaluate where we were and where we were going. And during that period of time, I think is when the early '90s, when the record business really changed. And when we got back to kind of deciding we were ready to record again, the business had changed so drastically that we didn't feel we had a place in it.
Mm-hmm.
We did explore the traditional major label situation at that time, and it was in 1996, and it just was bleak and it didn't feel right. People were telling us what to do. Oh, you should do this, and here's a song for you, and all. And we're like, wait a minute, we don't need that. We know how to make records. We've been doing it our whole lives.
Yeah.
And that was when the light bulb went off in our heads, and we said, well, who cares? We'll just put our own records out to our fans, and if we sell, you know, half the amount, it makes no difference because we'll make twice the amount of money. So it wasn't really brain surgery. I mean, it was easy to figure out. And fortunately for us, of course, we had a fan base and we had a name that we could parlay into, you know, some, you know, it wasn't like we were a new group starting out independently. So
so
we did that in 1997 with an album called Marigold Sky, and we never looked back. Every album that we put out, which is four albums at this point since that time, have all been released independently. We had a number one single with Do It For Love on that particular album, and we had put out a Christmas album. So we have, you know, we realize, well, wait a minute, we now have the freedom to not only be our own bosses, but we can put out music when and how we want. We can do the type of music we want. And for an artist like us, you know, after years and years of being in the business, that's really, to me, I guess it's kind of the payoff. You know, it's hopefully what you earn after that amount of time of paying your dues and being there. So we feel really good about it. And now with my new solo album, 1,000 Miles of Life, I'm, you know, I put that out independently as well, just like I did with my first solo album in 2001. So, you know, it's just, it feels good, you know. It feels good to put it out for the fans, let the people who really like you find it and enjoy it, and really the rest of the world just falls into place.
Well, let's talk about that solo album a little bit. I was reading your bio, and it was really cool to see that it, you know, after all these years, that your writing processes and your recording processes are still a real growing experience, and you're still learning and trying new things. And from your bio, it seemed like this album was a big step for you, and as far as, you know, felt like you really got to do what you wanted to do. What was the songwriting process behind this album? And what do you normally do as a songwriter when you approach writing a new record?
Well, this album was unique. This album was completely different than any recording I've ever done in my life. I'm not the most prolific songwriter. I write on a regular basis, but I don't write a lot. It was a very unusual set of circumstances. Last year, about the past 2 years, a lot of people very close to me, very people who were important to me personally and professionally, who were mentors and part of my life in a big way, you know, passed away, and there was a lot of that going on. And I started to feel the pressure of time and feel like, well, you know, after all these years, you know, I just never felt, as an artist and as a songwriter in particular, I never really made the musical statement that I think I was capable of. I just felt there was something else. And you know, being known and having a reputation as a pop songwriter is a great thing. And believe me, I'm very proud of it and proud of the Hall & Oates legacy. But at the same time, I felt there was other things that I wanted to talk about and write about. And this, all of a sudden, this emotional kind of swing gave me the impetus and the inspiration to start digging a little deeper in my songwriting process. And so between August of 07 and Christmas of 07, I just got on this incredible writing tear, and I started to write. It was almost like I was possessed. I mean, I don't want to sound too weird about it, but I really almost couldn't stop writing. And there was times when I was in my home studio doing a demo of a new song, and I'd get an idea for another song, and I would stop the demo and start writing the other song, and then, you know, and I was like, I'm going to forget what I did. You know, it was like really weird. I mean, it was almost like I couldn't stop myself. And these songs just poured out of me, and that has never happened in my entire life. So when that started happening, I was so excited about it that I thought, I have to just somehow sustain this energy and this whatever magic is going on. I have to keep this flowing into the recording process. And so I booked the studio in Nashville immediately, as quick as I could. And the quickest I could get in there was March. So, you know, the writing was pretty much done by January. And so January and February, I remember distinctly, I was like chomping at the bit because I had all this material and I had all these demos and I was like ready to go. So I used that period of time to really play the songs a lot out live. And I had never done that before. I had never really played the songs before the record was recorded. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I went out and played a lot of coffee houses, a lot of little singer-songwriter venues, and I got a chance to perform the songs, and I found out what works and what didn't. I refined them a bit, and then went directly in the studio in Nashville in March. Sorry, I got a little answering machine going on.
That's
back.
All right.
But anyway, so that's really what happened. It was very unique. I had never done that. And then of course, the recording process was amazing because I assembled this incredible cast of players and guest stars and then cut 12 tracks in 4 days.
Wow.
Three tracks a day, and every track came out perfectly.
Wow.
It was this weird, I don't know, the muse was it with me, and the musical gods were looking down on me. It was just one of those great, great recording experiences, which honestly, I can remember a handful of them,
yeah.
You know, in 30 years. So this was a very special album for me.
Some men must build their castles to the sky. Some men must search the ocean blue. But I find my fortune in my family.
You mentioned having a home studio. So when you're approaching a songwriter, especially for this album, were you like working with like a musical idea or a lyrical idea and just tracking it and building off of that? Or would you basically work up a whole song basically on acoustic guitar, then start layering some tracks and forming the bigger idea?
I have a way of working. One thing I do is I use GarageBand.
Uh-huh.
I'm a very big advocate of Apple's GarageBand. I hate engineering and I suck as an engineer. and I hate wasting time
yeah.
engineering. And GarageBand for me as a songwriting tool, as just I call it, you know, a digital sketch pad, really.
Yeah.
Because it's so user-friendly and easy to use that I can get my ideas and really realize them very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I care about. My home studio is geared totally toward the writing process. And even though, of course, I could make a record there if I wanted to, it's not really what I wanted. Plus, I wanted live players.
Yeah.
So I used it in a unique way. And I actually demoed the entire album on GarageBand. And I did all the background vocals. I did all the parts, so that when I went to Nashville, I I sent copies of these songs to the various players in advance so they could kind of get a handle on them. Mm-hmm. So when they walked in the studio, they already kind of knew what I wanted. And then we played it like a real band, you know, and of course they took it to another level. But, you know, my writing process can go in any direction. Sometimes it's a lyrical idea that, like a hook, a title that could be the beginning of it, that could be the germ of the seed of the song. Other times it could be a riff. Mm-hmm. So really there's no rules, and I try to keep an open mind about it. You know, sometimes you come up with a drum beat and start strumming some chords, the next thing you know, you're writing. Mm-hmm. Other times I've written in almost entire lyrics in my head, you know, when I'm like on a bike ride or hiking or skiing, and then, you know, run home, hope I don't forget it, you know, that kind of thing. That song, Circle of Three, which is actually the last song on the album, I actually wrote almost the entire lyric while I was skiing.
Hmm.
And it was really weird because I was having a great ski day, but I wanted to get home before I forgot it.
Had to choose between the snow or good song.
In this case, the artistic, won over the athletic.
So with the Hall & Oates projects you guys do together, is your writing process different for that since there's two of you writing, or is it similar?
In essence, it's the same. I think, you know, every time I've even collaborated with other writers, whether they be Nashville writers or friends or other writers, the process is always very similar. Mm-hmm. Everyone brings their own little personal quirks and personal approach to it. But in essence, writers are almost universally approach writing the same way. You know, you throw out ideas and you bounce them around, and one hopefully leads to another, and you know, you have to have trust in the collaborator, the person you're working mm-hmm. with, so that, you know, if you throw out what might be a really stupid idea, you're not embarrassed because that stupid idea could lead someone to thinking of something amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing. And Daryl and I, you know, write that way, but we write with other people, we collaborate. And over the years, I think since we've been together for so long, we do a lot of our writing individually. We write with, as I said, bring in other people. It keeps it fresh. So mm-hmm. the Hall & Oates writing process has grown into more of a writing family. And that changes. Whereas my solo album was much more focused.
Well, now that you guys are releasing albums independently and, you know, people always talk about the decline of CD sales, do you have new strategies you're trying as far as like releasing the music and promoting the albums that you might not have done, say, 15, 20 years ago?
Well, I think you have to be more creative. You have mm-hmm. to look outside the box and be very, very open-minded about how you're going to get the word out on the record. I mean, that's the exact challenge that I'm in the midst of right now, because my album just was released yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, it's all about how do you get the word out without traditional radio and a hit record and, you know, the traditional ways that the establishment of music business establishment used to promote, you know, with a poster in the record store and mm-hmm. an ad in the, you know, in Rolling Stone and hopefully a hit single. You know, all those things are just shattered. You know, they're really gone. And, you know, I'm promoting my album through word of mouth. I'm doing it through press, doing it through, you know, a lot of things like NPR, that type of radio, you know, and playing live and telling people about it. So it's really, I think this album in particular, because it was conceived as a whole piece, which of course in this day and age is probably an anachronism because people download and cherry pick, you know, a lot of their music.
Mm-hmm.
But this album was really conceived, you know, as a entire piece because it's really about certain themes about life and you know, and moving on and spiritualism and family, and that's what this album's about. It's a kind of a grown-up album, I'd say, and frankly, you know, at my age and with the type of experience I've had, I shouldn't be making any other type of album. So, so anyway, Thousand Miles of Life is the title, and needless to say, it really does sum up the whole spirit of the album. But, you know, it's kind of cool to be creative and figure out ways of getting it out there. I mean, I'm doing everything from going on news talk shows on MSNBC and Bloomberg Television, and who knows, I might be talking about politics and God knows what. But it doesn't really matter. It's really, you know, hopefully you get the word out and people hear it and say, oh, and they tell their friends and, you know, that sort of thing. So, I just feel like I made the best record I could. I made exactly the type of recording I wanted to make with absolutely no constraints and no compromise. There was no record company looking over my shoulder. There was no radio considerations to say I need a hit single. And that's kind of a freeing thing because I realized I could absolutely make a pure musical statement with no other considerations other than what I thought was right. And I don't think I can honestly say I've ever done that in my entire career.
That's cool. That's really cool. One thing I'm kind of curious about is I know it's your label and you're releasing it independently, but what kind of support staff do you have behind you helping to facilitate some of these things? Is it just you and a few people, or do you hire a bunch of like independent contractors to work certain things like promoting a single or maybe some film placements or things like that? Or how do you kind of structure your independent label?
Well, we do have a complete team. First of all, I have a management team that, you know, kind of quarterbacks the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we have a radio guy, although on this album we are specifically not going to radio with a particular song saying this is the song. Mm-hmm. We're not doing it. We're waiting on that. If radio discovers it and there's a consensus on a particular song, of course we'll support it. But as I said, this record is about word of mouth, and it's about press, and it's about integrity. And that's what I'm going for. So I have two sets of publicists, one in California and one in Nashville, working different segments of the world. You know, our California publicist is the one that handles Hall & Oates and is doing more of the mainstream kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the Nashville publicist is doing Americana and folk and you know, that world which I don't normally reach into, but where I believe there's some material on this album that fits in that kind of thing, because it's kind of, I call it a folk soul album. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I'm hitting it from two different angles, and the other stuff is press. I mean, it's all about press, just talking it up and letting the world know that it's out there.
Well, cool. Well, do you have any advice for artists out there that are just getting their feet wet and trying to chart a direction in a music career?
Well, I say, you know, it's a challenging time, and at the same time, it's an exciting time, and it has a lot of potential. It's tough in that you have to, you know, there's so much out there to cut through it all, but at the same time, there are a lot of avenues to get exposure, you know, YouTube and all the digital, you know, venues. And people are out there. I've noticed that, you know, I think people are taking a more grassroots approach. You know, they're playing their songs for, you know, live, and then they're selling them, literally selling them on the spot, you know. And I think that's a great way to do it. I think it's direct. It really makes a real connection between the artist and the audience. And I think that's a successful combination. You know, it's not mega. And, you know, if you're playing a little coffee house or a folk club or something, sure, you may only be playing to 100 people or whatever. But, you know, if 25 buy that album or CD and you sign it for them, I think you've made a connection there. And I think that's really what people have to realize. And don't have your sights set on the stars, you know. You know, keep your eye on the white line on the road, and just follow it, you know. And if you're good and you deliver, I think there's an audience out there for you.
All the tragedy that lives inside, all the sadness that he tries to hide, won't keep.
Well, cool, that's great advice. Well, I think that's gonna do it. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to be on the show.
Well, I appreciate you having me, and we'll see what happens. This is my first release on CD Baby, so I'm real excited about it.
Well, cool. We're excited about it, too.
Okay, man.
Well, we've come to the end of another show, and I do want to say a special thanks to John. And I'd like to mention that all the music used in today's show is from John's latest solo album titled 1,000 Miles of Life, and that album is available through cdbaby.com. And before I wrap up, I just wanted to remind you that we are in the middle of October Podfest, where we'll be bringing you a new episode every week during October. We usually put out a new episode every other week, so that means if you have a comment, story, or feedback to share, and you want it to make it in the next roundtable episode, you have less time than normal. So rush to the phone or to the email and let us hear from you. You can call us at our listener feedback line at 206-426-5683. That's 206-426-5683. And you can email us as well at info@cdbabypodcast.com. And you've probably heard me say that the stories that listeners have been phoning in has quickly become one of my favorite parts of the show, and that is true, I'm not lying. So keep the goods coming, and we'll catch you next week as October Podfest continues. You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.
Yeah, he's a good son.